Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, George W. Bush says a proposed trade deal with Colombia is crucial and beneficial for all concerned. Rather than dig into that claim, corporate media are making fun of anyone who would dispute it, favoring congressional critics with headlines like, "Democrats pander to big labor, flirt with return to protectionism." That's USA Today, and yes, they said big labor. With major media singing pretty much one note, we'll get another take from Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Also on the show, the right-wing base of the Republican Party has never much cared for John McCain. Their failed effort to deny him the party's presidential nomination was well covered in the mainstream press. Have McCain and the movement made up? We'll talk to journalist and author Rick Perlstein, who covered the story for The Nation magazine. That's coming up, but first, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ray Crocker were back in Washington recently to give their assessment of the Iraq War. The Senate hearings generated less coverage than their last visit to Washington for a variety of reasons. Some warnings from the media sounded a bit odd. The uptick in violence in Iraq, for example, wasn't going to be helpful to their argument that the U.S. troop surge was bringing down violence. The New York Times dealt with this by saying these new statistics threaten to reignite public concern about the cost of the war. There's something telling about framing public discussion about a violent and costly war as being a threat. The Associated Press, meanwhile, chimed in by reporting, quote, "The hearing on Iraq depicted just how deeply divided Americans remain on the war," close quote. Americans, meaning the public, aren't really divided about the war. They want it to end. That reality doesn't show up very often in elite political and media circles. As Zach Roth pointed out on the Columbia Journalism Review website, the unpopularity of the Iraq War with the public wasn't in the coverage of the big daily newspapers. That said, it's worth noting what happens when such topics do make it into media discussions about the war. When Nation editor Katrina Vandenhoevel appeared on ABC's This Week on April 6th, she argued that a responsible withdrawal from Iraq was the best strategy. Longtime ABC pundit Cokie Roberts weighed in, saying that, quote, "Convincing the electorate of that, I think, would be very difficult," close quote. But the public has been supportive of that idea for several years now. The only folks who still need convincing are pundits like Cokie Roberts.
In a bizarre appearance on Anderson Cooper's CNN show on April 4th, guest David Gergen credited John McCain for courage for admitting he was wrong to oppose a Martin Luther King holiday back in 1983. As opposed to that admiration, though, Gergen expressed disdain and confusion that Hillary Clinton mentioned poverty in remembering Dr. King. Gergen explained that Clinton could have chosen to, quote, "rise to the occasion and talk about how wonderful it is 40 years later that both an African American and a woman are now competing in the way they are," close quote. But instead, Gergen went on, she talked about, quote, "this poverty czar," saying she was going to put a poverty czar in the cabinet, whatever that means, in what many, many will interpret as a clear pander to John Edwards, close quote. Now, it's possible that Clinton mentioned poverty because it was a major concern of Dr. King's, who was in the midst of organizing the Poor People's March on Washington when he went to the aid of poor sanitation workers in Memphis, where he was assassinated. But Cooper failed to challenge Gergen's ignorant broadside, which might not have occurred at all had the U.S. media spent even a little time over the last 40 years discussing the actual Martin Luther King, who fought racism, poverty, and militarism, instead of the television fantasy King, who Gergen is now free to claim would have exulted in the advanced state of race relations and social justice as signified by the Obama and Clinton candidacies.
The New York Times recently explained why the paper had not published a single story about Winter Soldier, the recent hearings in which vets offered harrowing testimony about the atrocities they had witnessed in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. In a letter to media activists, Times public editor Clark Hoyt stated that the Times D.C. Bureau had, quote, "not been aware of the group or its meeting," close quote. The Bureau would have had to work hard to maintain such ignorance. The AP Newswire carried a story on the hearings, and the organizing group, Iraq Veterans Against the War, sent the D.C. Bureau three separate rounds of different press releases. The D.C.-based Institute for Public Public Accuracy sent its own press releases about Winter Soldier to at least 150 Times staffers. Hoyt's letter went on to explain that one of the Times' three Pentagon reporters was unavailable to cover the hearings because the reporter was traveling with the Secretary of Defense. Hoyt also remarked that, quote, news organizations like the Times, with its own substantial investment in independent reporting from Iraq, tend to prefer their own on-scene accounts of the war, close quote. It's hard to know what readers should make of the suggestion of stretched resources. Media organizations like Democracy Now!, In These Times, and Alternet were able to cover the Winter Soldier hearings, all on a tiny fraction of the Times' budget. It's even harder to see how the paper could sell as independence, a decision to ignore first-hand accounts by soldiers offering substantive challenge to the official line in order to cover the orchestrated movements of top government officials.
New York Times columnist Frank Rich began his April 6th column, quote, really, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton should be ashamed of themselves for libeling John McCain, close quote. Rich was referring to Obama and Clinton's allusions to McCain's response to the possibility of the U.S. being in Iraq for 50 more years, which was, make it 100, that'd be fine with me. Rich, along with other mainstream critics like the Washington Post fact-checker, factcheck.org, and the Columbia Journalism Review, think it's very unfair to cite McCain's willingness to stay in Iraq for a century without noting that he added a qualifier, quote, as long as Americans are not being injured or harmed or wounded or killed, close quote. This is seen as unfair, evidently, because when you hear that someone wants U.S. troops to be in Iraq for 100 years, you naturally assume that means that U.S. troops would be in danger for 100 years, especially if you believe what McCain himself said a couple of sentences later, that Iraq is in, quote, a very volatile part of the world where al-Qaeda is training, recruiting, equipping, and motivating people every single day, close quote. In other words, it's because McCain's claim is so nonsensical that Rich and others contend that his critics should have to spell out his far-fetched rationale. But this isn't how things usually work. Imagine if a politician had said they proposed immediately releasing all violent prisoners in the country, but oh, they would all be given a magic pill that would prevent them from posing any harm to anyone else. It's tough to picture pundits scolding opponents for not discussing the idea in its full context. They'd more likely see it as proponents' job to defend such a hard-to-swallow idea.
And finally, Newsweek's April 14th cover story, Who's the Greenest of Them All?, is remarkably favorable to Republican candidate John McCain. Remarkable because McCain's record is pretty bad. His score, as tallied by the League of Conservation Voters, was exactly zero for 2007. But that's information readers don't get to until well after being told that the League hasn't said they wouldn't endorse McCain, though they haven't said they would either. Newsweek reports that McCain sided with environmentalists on the talismanic issue of protecting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A more honest accounting would also note that McCain sided against environmentalists on Arctic drilling in 1995 and again in 2005. In other words, both before and after the 2003 vote Newsweek cites, in which he opposed the drilling. But that's not really a problem for Newsweek, where McCain's muddled environmental record somehow proves he's more passionate about the issues than Democrats, who are just reflexive tree huggers. Quote, ironically, McCain, with a voting record that would put him at the bottom of the heap among Democrats, is sometimes perceived as more passionate about the environment than his Democratic opponents, whose objectively much stronger records are viewed as a matter of party orthodoxy, close quote. That's media's McCain in a nutshell. It doesn't matter what he actually does, so much as what he's perceived to do, as opposed to what his opponents are viewed as doing. The fact that the environment is impacted by actions, not perceptions or views, seems to be beside the point.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In In an April 10th editorial headlined "Drop Dead Columbia," the Washington Post excoriated House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for holding up passage of a proposed trade promotion deal with Colombia. With the hysteria the paper seems to reserve for this issue, the Post declared, quote, "The year 2008 may enter history as the time when the Democratic Party lost its way on trade," close quote. Refusing to waive the trade deal through without challenge is an error of historic proportion because, economically, the Post says, it should be a no-brainer. The paper would also have readers consider that the deal deserves support as, quote, "a reward to a friendly democratic government that has made tremendous strides on human rights despite harassment from Venezuela's Hugo Chavez," close quote. Thus, the paper hits on the key points that seem to recur in corporate media's coverage of the Colombia Trade Pact, that the deal will undisputedly create U.S. jobs while also being good for Colombia, which is doing just fine on human rights, as well as having the added benefit of being an affront to favored media target Hugo Chavez. Here to help us assess that assessment of the deal is Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mark Weisbrot.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, on the economics, the Washington Post explains that the Colombia deal goes like this. Quote, "At the moment, Colombian exports to the United States already enjoy preferences. The trade agreement would make those permanent, but it would also give U.S. firms free access to Colombia for the first time, thus creating U.S. jobs," close quote. USA Today says most U.S. exporters to Colombia would see their tariffs slashed to zero, and this could mean great savings to a company like Caterpillar. And they also note that Colombia would get nothing from it other than the permanent extension of the status quo. So I feel like I'm hearing two messages here, that Americans shouldn't worry about this deal because Colombia's not really going to get much out of it. And then at the same time, it's a win-win and even some sort of gift to Colombia. In economic terms, what's going on here?
Well, it's hard to imagine it's going to create jobs in the U.S. You know, the U.N. Economic Commission for Latin America looked at it and decided it would create a net benefit to the United States of, well, the number is so small you can barely read it. It basically comes out to a one-time increase of one penny per U.S. citizen. So that's not very much. On the Colombian side, you know, it's going to hurt their textiles, apparel, food industries. So I don't think they're going to get much out of it either. There will be some corporations that will get something. But what I think they're trying to do is trying to lock Colombia in more to the NAFTA kind of model and more to integrate their economy with the U.S. when you have a lot of South American integration going on, economic integration right now. And that's, I think, why they see it as strategically important. It is kind of political for them. You know, until recently, Colombia, for example, had agreed to join the Bank of the South with the other countries. It was the alternative to the IMF and the World Bank, with Venezuela and Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Bolivia and Ecuador. They're all in there. And so that would be the drift of Colombia if the United States wasn't kind of using both the war and these kind of economic agreements to pull them into their fold.
Well, editorialists haven't really been hiding that political element here, though it's a totally unexplored given in these pieces that we should use economic policy decisions about U.S. jobs and lives as a political stick or carrot to favor or punish this or that regime. But the point, maybe even the major point about the Colombia deal, is that Uribe is, as USA Today has it, a solid ally and a counterweight to Venezuelan strongman Hugo Chavez. The LA Times says not doing the deal would push Latin American governments, quote, closer to hostile leftist rivals such as Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, close quote. So at the same time as we're being told that it's kind of just an economic no-brainer deal with one country, clearly it's about something much bigger.
No, I think so. There's, again, a lot of politics involved in there. Venezuela and Colombia, for example, have quite a bit of trade themselves now, and this has been a factor which has kept them from really running into problems with each other at several junctures. And in fact, for most of the last 6 years, Chavez has gone out of his way to maintain very good relations with Uribe, despite them being on opposite sides of the political spectrum. And of course, this did break down in the last few months, but that was with quite a push from the Bush administration, too, since they're not interested in negotiations over the release of hostages held by the FARC, and everybody else in South America is. Again, there's quite a bit of politics. The media kind of pretend like this is primarily a trade agreement when the trade impacts are so minuscule is, I think, somewhat of an exaggeration.
Yeah, on the economic front, the reality and the rhetoric seem to be miles apart. You've got the Washington Post saying that if Clinton and Obama refuse this Colombia Pact, that would damage the U.S. economy, you know, and ultimately reduce job prospects for the very workers they purport to be trying to protect. That just seems very far afield of the actual impact of this agreement.
No, that's ridiculously far-fetched. And what they're really worried about, though, there is something going on, and that is, you know, these so-called free trade agreements have not really produced positive results for anyone. You know, Mexico has had NAFTA now for 15 years, and their growth has been sluggish, the wage growth even worse. And now the countries that have integrated with the United States, either through NAFTA or CAFTA, Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean, they're going to be the hardest hit of all by this recession that the U.S. is in. So the general lessons that people are drawing is that it isn't really safe to tie yourself that closely to the U.S. market, especially at a time when the U.S. has this unsustainable trade deficit. At the same time, this whole ideology, I call them free trade agreements in quotes because they put up many barriers, as many as they really take down very often, they're falling out of favor. And that's because, again, you know, these countries have had a lot of experience now with this particular model, and it has failed pretty badly on a world scale.
Well, let me ask you briefly, because it has come up a lot in this coverage, some critics of the PACs are pointing to violence and human rights violations in Colombia, particularly those affecting trade unionists. And major media have been especially dismissive of these claims. USA Today said it's a red herring because, you know, Colombia is an unusually violent place. So apparently violence against organizers is nothing of note. And the Washington Post said the concern is flimsy because Colombia has had remarkable success in quelling civil conflict, so much so that, they note triumphantly, regular people are getting killed now at a higher rate than union organizers. You know, questioning whether politicians are really concerned about what they say they're concerned about is fine with me, but I wonder what you make of this presentation of the civil rights situation in Colombia and of the use of that element in this trade story.
Well, that's the editorialist and a rather extreme bunch, I would say. If you look at the news articles in those same papers, the Washington Post and Juan Ferrero has had some very good articles on the repression in Colombia, and so has the Los Angeles Times, showing the large increase in killings by the military. You know, they disbanded some of the death squads, the paramilitary death squads, and so what's happened is the military has been increasing its killing, and we're talking about extrajudicial executions, which have soared in the last 4 years. So this is, again, I guess the case of the editorial boards not reading their own newspapers. I should say the newspaper reporting hasn't been that great. There was only one AP story in the last few weeks reporting that 6 out of the 10 organizers of a march against paramilitary violence in Colombia and military violence, 6 out of the 10 organizers of that march were killed. And this shows you, by the way, that this is a real bias of the media. If you had even one person killed in Venezuela that was organizing anything opposed to the government, which hasn't happened, that would be front page news. And this was buried. There was only one AP article that I could find about it.
We've been speaking with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find them online at cepr.net. Thanks very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Sure, thank you.
John McCain's been called a lot of things. One radio host said he threatened the American way of life as we've always known it. One senator was horrified by the very thought of McCain in the White House. "It sends a cold chill down my spine," he said. The funny thing is, this is what conservatives are saying about John McCain. The crack-up within the right wing over McCain's campaign became a hot mainstream media story for a few weeks there. How could a GOP contender manage to finish at the top of the heap despite being so loathed by the so-called right-wing noise machine? Is that movement hopelessly divided, or were they never that powerful to begin with? And maybe more importantly, are they changing their tune on John McCain? Journalist Rick Perlstein wrestled with all of these questions in a cover story for The Nation magazine. He's the author of the forthcoming Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. Rick Perlstein, welcome back to Counterspin.
Great to be here.
Now, the story of McCain's trouble with the Republican base was pretty well reported earlier in the campaign season. He couldn't be trusted. He's a Democrat and so on. Things have shifted a bit since McCain more or less bagged the nomination. How did this play out exactly?
Well, the fascinating thing is what you're hearing from what I call the professional conservatives, that basically the people who make their living claiming to represent the conservative masses, was that, of course, McCain was the devil incarnate. Only problem is the conservative masses then went out and voted for McCain. Basically, he showed that the emperor, being Rush Limbaugh, if you can stand the image, has no clothes. It's been quite a revelation. I mean, you ask whether they never had as much power as they think they did, or they just are losing their power. That's kind of an open question, because one of the most important things about the so-called conservative noise machine is that they operate on this theory that no Republican presidential candidate, Senate candidate, congressional candidate, etc., can basically get elected without their imprimatur. And McCain sort of decided to call their bluff. He didn't go hat in hand to Rush Limbaugh like every Republican presidential candidate is supposed to. He didn't go hat in hand to Dobson. He didn't go hat in hand to the Richard Vigories of the world. And he wasn't hurt for it. If it was ever true that these guys had any kind of special power to be kingmakers in the Republican Party, it's certainly not true now.
And you're arguing in the piece that it's not ideology, really, that presents a problem for McCain with the base, because he's more or less with them. It's this kind of this cultural thing with conservatism. They demand a certain thing from their candidates.
It's the ring-kissing, stupid. I mean, there's a couple things going on. On the mass level, you know, for just about every conservative of every description, a big part of conservative identity is based on the feeling of resentment at being condescended to it by elites, liberal elites, basically. When people look down their noses at you, and that's what kind of manufactures conservatives. But, you know, far too often to conservatives, McCain has looked like one of these nose-thumbing liberal elites to them. And again, it's not the positions. Most of his positions are quite conservative. He scores an 82 on the American Conservative Union scale, that sort of thing. But what he has refused to do is kind of humble himself before them. And he's also refused to humble himself before their leaders. And, you know, Tom DeLay went on George Stephanopoulos' show and admitted as much. He said, "I don't think they're demanding that he change his position. It is attitude." So what we're talking about is psychological, it's cultural, it's tribal. It's kind of gussied up in these ideological objections. But after all, one of the things that Reverend Dobson said made McCain unacceptable was his foul language. And, you know, I'm sure Dobson has never endorsed anyone who used foul language before.
Definitely not.
Well, no, he's never endorsed anyone who hasn't, you know, come to Colorado Springs and begged for his sufferance.
Well, have they changed at all in their attitude toward McCain? I know people like Sean Hannity railed against McCain, and then when they sat down to interview him, it was a different story.
Well, it's all about power. These guys have no power without a Republican in the White House, and they've tried to kind of wrap around 180 degrees. The best example in my article was Michael Reagan, who said that my father, Ronald Reagan, would have nothing to do with John McCain. You know, he despised him. He has contempt for the American people. He has contempt for conservatives. Then 8 days later, he wrote an article after McCain had clinched the nomination saying, if my dad was around now, he'd be campaigning his butt off for John McCain.
So it took a whole week, I guess.
Eight days.
Putting on a historian's hat for a second, is there a precedent for this where the base says, gosh, this guy just isn't with us? I mean, I've gone back looking at clips about Reagan early on in his first term, and there were people in the conservative base who weren't all that happy with Ronald Reagan. You'd never know it now, but...
Yeah, and there was this ritual, and people like Richard Vigory and later people like Rush Limbaugh and Dobson basically what they would do is they would accuse someone like Reagan of betraying conservatism. And the next step in the little game was Ronald Reagan would come hat in hand to them and apologize. And that is what John McCain has refused to do. And that has made him insufferable to them. But what can they do? They're not going to support Barack Obama. One person I quote says he wants to socialize whole sectors of the economy. So what we have is a conservative movement in profound disarray. I say that the conservative noise machine is kind of getting sand in the gears. They don't know what to do.
And doesn't this all, in a way, work in McCain's favor? On the one hand, you see these news magazine covers where it's him battling the likes of Coulter, Limbaugh, Hannity.
Sure.
Mainstream media people have to look at that and think, well, he's not such a bad guy. At the same time, you point out that when the Times ran their piece hitting McCain over this relationship with a lobbyist, the base did rally around him for a little while.
For a little while, there was a little blip of a rally. And, in fact, it is the case that when people like James Dobson say that John McCain is untrustworthy, that does probably make him a little more attractive to the vaunted independent voter. The problem is none of these guys are on the same page. They're in disarray. They're confused. Some are saying, well, he's changed. He is trustworthy. Some are saying, no, he hasn't changed. He's not trustworthy. And, you know, on the left, we like to kind of think of the conservative noise machine as this kind of finely calibrated unit that, you know, can turn on a dime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I can't really see how they're getting their act together enough for that to be the case this year.
Yeah, I saw Ann Coulter was interviewed recently, and she still says if it's between Hillary Clinton and John McCain, she's voting for Clinton. Do you think that they really mean it in the sense of just not having the passion for McCain ever?
It's hard to say. She was for Mitt Romney. Of course, Paul Wayrick was from Mitt Romney, too, and he just sent out a press release saying that if McCain chose Mitt Romney as his running mate, social conservative voters will consider their values repudiated by the Republican Party. Whatever Coulter says, whatever Limbaugh says, whatever accommodations they make or they don't make, what they won't be is coordinated. What they won't be is efficient. What they won't be is having a strong, unified message. And that can't be good no matter where these guys end up coming down on McCain.
Rick Perlstein is a journalist and author. His next book will arrive next month. It's called Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. You can read his story all aboard the McCain Express at thenation.com. Rick Perlstein, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Pleasure to be with you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.